the subject of a documentary film by filmmaker Melissa Lowry. As she reflects on the experiences of black girls, or the experiences black girls face growing up in predominantly white communities. So stay with us right here on KBOO 90.7 FM for It Takes a Village. We'll be right back. Welcome to KBOO's microphones, Melissa. Glad you could come in today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It'd be much better, if I put the mic on, huh?
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming down. And we're not going to try to keep you too long because we want you to enjoy some of the 4th of July festivities.
Oh, happy 4th of July, everybody. Hi, girls. I have to say hi to my girls real quick. Hi, Shay. Hi, Jayla.
No, that's quite all right. Let me first say I want to cover some specific areas. But first, what motivated you to make a film about this subject, black girls in suburbia?
Well, it started with my oldest daughter actually coming to me and sharing with me about a girl who told her that her hair was different, and this really made me reflect on my own experiences growing up in suburbia. But my daughter was the one that really kind of sparked this idea of what that's mm-hmm. like, and I really had to sit and think about what my experience was like, because it had been a minute, that I thought about that. So she was the one that kind of really sparked this idea, just why her hair was different, why she was the only brown kid in her class. And we had to have a talk about that. And so she kind of started the spark. And then the title of Black Girl in Suburbia just kind of popped into my head and just kind of went from there.
I know you've had some showings around town, one at the library on Killingsworth in Northeast Portland, and you probably have more showings, I suspect. Have the response been the same from black viewers as white viewers alike, or how has the responses been? Has the responses been kind of predictable by ethnicity or
That's not a really good question. Well, to start, the feedback that I'm getting that's kind of surprised me a little bit is how people are surprised at the diversity in the film, as far as the perspective. There's different perspectives on one shared experience, and people are really they're going into the film with an expectation. I'm not sure of exactly what that expectation is, but I guess of an expectation of this film to be another kind of quote unquote black, documentary on a certain experience that everybody, it's, kind of this sort of woe is me story, maybe. And so they're pleasantly surprised and happy that it's not that type of,
it's not that depressing,
right? this is a film where, at least for me, that this is the only way I knew how to make this film was to go out and talk to different people and get there, because everybody's different, everybody has a different perspective on one. We can all have share an experience, but since we're different people, we all see that experience differently, or we experience it differently. So I'm happy for that their expectations are of what they were thinking, going into the film. The outcome of that is different and positive, and so that's great. As far as me getting feedback from a difference between whites and blacks, I think with the white community, one interesting feedback, the buzz for Black Girl in Suburbia is really going around in the transracial adoption community, which has been really interesting and really great. And so I've had a lot of feedback from white mothers of Black daughters, and just them needing to see this film as kind of a guide as to how their children are navigating their way through life in a predominantly white world. So that's been really, really eye-opening for me as well, to get their perspective on this experience. And then from the Black community, like I said, I think it's they're going in thinking that this is another kind of woe is me sort of documentary, which it's not. So,
well, I guess the title does kind of lend itself to that. You know, when you say Black Girls in Suburbia, we know that the suburbia is predominantly white, and they
right,
are.
Right, that's the assumption. That's yes. Yeah.
Well, it's.
And it's true. It's true as well. Right. But it's, I mean, if you go to Atlanta and you talk about suburbs in Atlanta, you know, a lot of those suburbs in Atlanta are predominantly Black.
That's
so
true.
The assumption of suburbia.
Being that you were homegrown, so to speak, that you're from here, I guess it's the assumption, you know, that,
right.
Yeah, that is, but yeah. Well, let me ask you, this. One of your reviewers, I read a review of your film in the Portland Observer, and it quoted you as saying that you knew there was a difference when a white boy wouldn't drink out of the same water fountain as you. Were you fundamentally kind of naive about race up to that point in your life?
So that happened when I was around third grade.
Oh, that's okay.
Yes. So, my going back a little bit. So, I was born in Portland. We lived in Northeast until I was about 3, and then we moved out to Westland. But I actually was still going to school out here in Portland. I went to Sabin, and I went to a preschool out here in Portland. So, from what I remember in kindergarten, what I remember is that. My class was very diverse, actually. There was whites, blacks, Asian, Hispanic. Like, there was a melting pot of kids. So I didn't stand out. And so when I started first grade out in West Lynn, that's when I was like, oh, okay. So all of you guys kind of look the same. And then then there's me. But in third grade, the realization that my color actually offended people that people didn't like my skin color. Like, my color actually was, you know, a reason for somebody not to be around me or not to like me. That's when the race issue, I think, I realized that was an issue, you know, for people. So, and that was like right around third grade. But before that, I did notice a difference. I mean, obviously, you know, brown girl in a sea of white kids, you know, you as a child, you say, oh, and I had braids, so I was obviously different from everybody else. But it wasn't until that incident that I thought, oh, okay, so my color actually, not just how I look, but my color is, you know, making an effect on someone negatively.
Did it affect your grades at all, or affect your
feelings about being in school? No, it was more of a social kind of, I think it was more of, I realized after that incident, I think I just realized again how much more different I was, not just how I looked, but that my skin, you know, was going to make me, that there was going to be people out there that wasn't going to like me just because of my skin color. So I think with that, I kind of started building up a little bit of a wall and being very cautious about people. And eventually down the line, you know, as I got older and in school, and I think with a lot of blacks in Oregon as well, I think if you're working in a predominantly white office or whatnot, you kind of have to put on what you call kind of like, you kind of switch a little bit, where you have to kind of, you might have to hold yourself back from being completely who you are, you know, because you don't want to offend anybody, or you don't want to scare or be threatening to anybody, you know, as a black person. So I think I later down the line in schooling, I kind of realized that I needed to sort of hold back a little bit. Now, if I was around my other black friends or whatnot, then I could, you know, be myself. I could talk as loud as I could do, you know, say whatever. But you're kind of guarded, I think.
Yeah. One of the things that had occurred to me, seeing your review in the Portland Observer and your photograph, is that you're fairly fair skinned.
Yes.
You know, you light skin, as we would say, as we would say in the ghetto and so forth. Uh-huh. And you know, I was wondering, in terms of when you became conscious of like you say, skin color, did your family kind of prepare you, or your parents? Did anybody ever tell, were you sheltered coming up about
no.
race?
No, my mom was very vocal, very, my mother actually ran the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center off of Interstate for almost 20 years. So we were on the weekends, you know, and during the week we were at school in West Lynn. On the weekends we were actually over in Portland, and the firehouse was this melting pot of culture and different people and different experiences. And so we were around many different things. We were around the arts, we were around, you know, dance, you know, galleries, theater, all kinds of things, which brought in all kinds of people. So we were around, you know, all different kinds of people. So we were very aware of race and very aware of the world and people. But so being sheltered was not really, I wouldn't say we were sheltered at all. My mom wasn't that kind of parent. She kind of was the parent that kind of threw us into something and said, all right, figure it out, work it out, you know, kind of thing, and come back and tell me what you learned, you know, sort of. So, but for others, I would say, like, as far as being in West Lynn, because West Lynn is just a very small community, and the whites being there, a lot of them, and I'm not saying all of them, but a lot of them stayed in West Lynn, so they didn't get out very much. They didn't, you know, going to downtown Portland was like, you know, what, you're going to downtown? Oh my gosh, why and what for, like, and why would you go? Right. And so because there was very few people of color there, we kind of represented all people of color, because you know, or what, you know, if they went home and watched television, that's what they saw, you know, whatever they saw on TV represented people of color. And then coming to school and seeing the few of us there was like, oh, well, you guys are all kind of the same. So we got our black experience. You guys, you can be that, you know, sort of thing. So I think, you know, a lot of people growing up in West Lynn were very sheltered. And that's part of that experience of, you know, I call it like an innocent ignorance.
Well, obviously, if you grew up in the suburb, you were raised in the middle class, pretty much middle class household.
Yes, but yes, and I say but, because when I did tell, and that was the other part of my experience, when I would tell people I lived in West Lynn, it was, oh, you're rich, you have money, you live with the Blazers, you know, which was totally not the case at all. I always say I lived at the bottom of the hill, the Blazers lived at the top of the hill. You know, my cul-de-sac, it was families that had two jobs and had and did not have money. I was raised by a single parent raising three kids. She drove a Hyundai, so it wasn't like, you know, we lived in this huge house and, you know, a four-car garage.
That's the image that we, I think,
exactly,
not supposed to get.
Right. And people don't understand that even in the suburbs there's still these pockets of just regular people trying to live, you know, that don't have money.
When after the water fountain incident, when white boy refused to drink behind you, did you seclude yourself or become more or less Afrocentric? Because you talk about your hair and
it's third grade, so I try to.
At some point, usually, many of us we reach that point where we know that there's a difference, and we either embrace our culture or move away from our culture a little bit. What was the case with you?
So just as a child, right, you're trying to figure out who you are and what your identity, like, no matter race you are, right? You're going through hormones. You're just trying to figure it out. So
where you fit in the world.
Exactly. And that doesn't have race. That doesn't have anything to do with race. So there was that, right? And then on top of that, not seeing anybody that looks like you or it represents, you know, who you are out in the community, is tough. And so I would say towards high school is when, you know, which a lot of teenagers are trying to figure out who they are, and they try on different hats and, you know, try different friends just to figure out what that is. So, and I also went through that same process, but I also did go through my Black Power stage, which was I wore, you know, and this is the early 90s. So I wore my African medallions. I wore my cross colors. I wore my, you know, I went through that, you know.
You had dreadlocks in the photograph that I see.
Oh, I had braids. I always wore braids, not dreadlocks, but I always, you know, wore braids. So I like my freshman year was kind of that, you know, was that case for me where I was in my kind of, I'm Black, you know, I'm a Black girl in suburbia, but you know, I'm going to represent. But that quickly, just like a lot of, you know, phases that teenagers go through, you know, kind of phased out. And like by my senior year, after realizing, after all of these years of trying to navigate who I fit in with the white kids, with the Black kids, and, you know, from the Black side, I'm too white, right, and I talk like a valley girl, and I dress different, and I live out there, and, you know, with the rich folks, and then with the white kids, I'm not Black enough, but I also represent all Black people, so there's a lot of confusion, and you're trying to figure out, you know, your identity. But by my senior year, I was part of La Femmes, which is an African American organization, right? The debutante. And that really,
they're considered kind of bourgeoisie, by the way.
They are. It's like Jack and Jill, which we were also a part of as kids. Which my brother was funny because he was like, my mom tried to put him in Jack and Jill as well, and he was like, but I know I'm Black, so why do I have to be in a group to, you know, around other kids that live in the same place I do? But you know, we have to get together. Just, he's like, I'm good with that. But my senior year with La Femmes, I had a really good experience with that, and seeing that there's other Black kids that will accept me for who I am as Melissa, not because I'm Black, not because I live in West Lynn, but because I am who I am. And so by my senior year, I kind of, you know, made a decision and was like, look, I can be who I am around, you know, and be the only Black person in a room full of white people. I can be who I am as in a room full of all Black people and be okay, and not, you know, so no matter where I go, I'm okay with that. So I would say like around my senior year was when I kind of, you know, figured it all out, all of that identity and, you know, who I was. So
you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. It Takes a Village. I'm Shahid Hamid, your host, and today I am talking with Melissa Lowry, who is a filmmaker, and I'm talking about her recent film documentary, Black Girls in Suburbia. And I want to welcome her again to the microphones of KBOO. Melissa, you spoke about your daughter's experiences, and that's what motivated you to do the film. Can you give us an example of some of the experiences that she went through?
With my oldest daughter, so she kind of went through, you know, just other kids kind of showing her that, well, telling her that she's different. Like, and especially example with her hair. Like with Black girls, our hair is the one thing, well, you know, one of the big main things that makes us stand out is our hair. Our hair is obviously different. It can be kinky, curly. We can wear different styles. So, I mean, with me growing up, I wore braids, like, constantly. And when I wasn't wearing braids, my hair was, you know, in my little afro or afro puffs or whatnot. So, which made me stand out, you know, anyways. And with my girls, their hair is in braids a lot. And so that was one experience with my oldest daughter, and with my youngest daughter, an experience with her, you know, being the only one in the classroom. And during Black History Month, you know, all of the kids, her teacher talking about African American leaders, and then all of the kids in her class kind of looking at her and telling her that she is like Martin Luther King. And my, you know, and my daughter saying, but I'm not like Martin Luther King. You know, I'm not a civil rights leader. I don't know. You know, I'm learning just like you are, you know. But these other kids, only connection that they made between my daughter and Martin Luther King was the fact that she was Black. So that's another, you know, experience. And how do teachers navigate those conversations when, you know, you have one of your students who's very uncomfortable and not feeling okay to, you know, say that she's uncomfortable because the whole class is kind of this pressure of, well, you're Black and we're talking about Black people, so you must, you know, mm-hmm. be the same. And so that's another experience that a lot of kids in predominantly white communities kind of feel. And to me, a big part of this film is really to educate and to help, and hopefully to help, you know, teachers. I really would love for this to be kind of used as an educational tool to help teachers as well, and, you know, sort of navigate those conversations with their students.
It was reported that you want to one of the purposes that you envision is you want to spark conversation.
Yes.
Around this issue. What would you like your film to promote specifically or generate from these discussions, and maybe some, would you like them shown in schools? Or,
yes.
Have you approached the Portland Public Schools with it, or are you intending on?
Yeah, so I originally, starting out with this film, it just, in my head, I really was doing this for my daughters, just so that they could see that they weren't alone in their experiences. Mm-hmm. And then when I posted my trailer a few years ago on YouTube, I started getting all of these emails from women all over that grew up in suburbia saying, this is my experience, and this is, like, you know, I'm so glad somebody is voicing this, because when I Googled Black Girl in Suburbia originally, nothing came up. There was no information on this particular experience, and I was really shocked about that. So when these women were emailing me and saying, thank you, you know, nobody's sharing this, and I've never talked about this before, and I thought, okay, so this is something a little bit bigger than what I had expected. And I thought, we need to talk about it. And for me, the way that I learn and the way that I grow and I become aware of things is having conversations with people, because that's the best way. That's where change starts, is just having a conversation. And so for me, after getting feedback from people and hearing from people's perspectives about this, I thought, well, that's just what we have to do. So one of my main purposes with the film is to spark that conversation. And it's we talk about a variety of subjects that anyone, no matter what race you are, what culture you are, you can pick something away from that, and it's going to spark something in you to want to talk and want to say, you know, I'm not a Black girl in suburbia, but I can relate to feeling isolated and feeling alone and going through an identity, trying to find my identity, and, you know, not being able to communicate with teachers or whatever the case is. But whatever that is, at the end of the movie, you feel like you need to share, or you need to talk about it, and you want to, you know, get people into the conversation. And that's, you know, one conversation leads to another conversation, and it leads to awareness. And, you know, you might go into another conversation with a completely different attitude from before because of what you've seen and who you've talked to. And so, and that's where kind of change happens. So,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Your teachers, how was your relationship with your teachers? Did you notice any behavioral changes with your teachers, or
I
toward you, or anything of that nature?
I don't remember having a specific experience with a teacher in that regard. My first grade teacher was lovely. She, and thank God I had a teacher like her. She was very supportive, very caring, and I just remember, because I think she saw the freaked out look on my face, you know, the first few days of school, and she really kind of took me under her wing. So, one story I have is from a friend, one of the very few African-American kids at our school, and an experience she shared with me was, you know, again, during Black History Month in high school, and a teacher was talking about Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. And she decided the best way to tell the story was to reenact it. And so guess who got to be Rosa Parks? My friend got to be Rosa Parks, and she had the rest of the kids kind of, you know, my friend in a chair and had the rest of the kids kind of come on and kind of yell at her like she was Rosa Parks. And mm-hmm. call her names and that kind of thing. And it was traumatizing for her. She didn't share that with me till we were, you know, like there was grown.
Freedom ride exercises.
Yeah, and this teacher, for some reason, now I'm not sure what her now her intention could might not have been to be mean or to be disrespectful or anything, but her intention might have been coming from, well, this is an exercise, and if they do it, then, you know, they might get more out of it. But she was not thinking about my friend who was trauma. Like, she was serious. Yes, she was seriously like, this is wrong. I don't want to be Rosa Parks. Like, you know, so.
Now, this was a young black girl saying this?
This is a friend of mine who I went to high school with. She was another black girl that went to Westland. And, yeah, but it's just one of those things. And again, that's why I just, it's so important for me for teachers to understand that there's these little, that sensitivity. And if those teachers aren't comfortable with themselves talking about race and they don't have that experience, then they're not gonna, you know, be able to have those conversations. So.
What about the whole area of integrating with did you have any white friends at all integrating with the other, with the predominant population of the school? Did you have any white folks that come over and reached out to you or in any way? Or
yeah, so I had my friends in Westland were great. I had great, like I said, I had a pretty normal suburban childhood, like just like anybody who grew up. You know, I played, I had friends, we talked. The only difference was that my friends didn't know that I was going through this experience. And had I shared with them what I was going through, there was no way they would have been able to understand, you know, because that's not their reality. That wasn't their reality at the time. But I had, you know, I had great friends. I, you know, we rode bikes. We went to parties. We, you know, hung out. So I was on dance team in high school. So I had a fairly normal upbringing, you know, aside from the single parent and aside from, you know, being my mom driving a Hyundai and being black in suburbia. Aside from
that, everything was fine.
Other than that, it was a pretty normal, you know, I was a pretty normal kid, you know.
There's a lot today is what is normal, you know.
Right. What is today. Exactly? So what is considered normal? Yeah.
Well, we're out of time, but I certainly want to thank you, Melissa, for taking time out of your holiday schedule to come down and,
absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Share some of your thoughts with us. Yes, and you're going to be, I think, on Bread and Roses at the end of the month.
Yes. Come back to KBOO on the 25th, I believe, July 25th.
Yeah, July 25th.
Yes.
So that will be on our website. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
You
can also check out the website www.blackgirlinsuburbia.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Check for updates for upcoming screenings. I believe we just booked a screening for the Hillsborough Library in October. So that date will be up on the website as well on Facebook.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We'll keep an eye out for the screening sites and so forth, and try to let folks know where they can see Black Girls in Suburbia.
Happy 4th of July, everybody.
Thank you so much. Stay tuned for more of It Takes a Village here on our 4th of July holiday schedule. I have Mr. Michael Grice coming in, and we're going to talk a little bit about gentrification right here on KBOO. So stay with us. Thank you. It Takes a Village, our extended edition, 4th of July edition of It Takes a Village. And we certainly want to thank Melissa Lowry for coming down to the station today to talk about her new film. And on this particular portion of our program, and we'd like to remind you that the Blues Festival is coming to you live beginning at 12 o'clock or thereafter and so forth. So stay tuned for that. Your Inner City Blues Connection, KBOO 90.7 FM, as we broadcast the Blues Festival. Yes, a lot of notable artists: Maceo Parker, Buzz Skaggs, Curtis Salgado. I think he'll be on Sunday though. So they have a list, I think, on the website, so you can check that out. On this portion of the program, I'd like to welcome Mr. Michael Grice. Many of you know him. He's an educator. He's also one of the co-founders of the World Arts Foundation. Puts on the yearly Martin Luther King celebration. And this year, I understand it's going to be the 30th year. That's the 30th anniversary, Michael?
That's correct.
Yeah. So we want to, however, today talk about gentrification in the Alberta Street project. So let's begin. Many of us call Michael Chappie, and many of you know him as Chappie, so we want to pardon us if we slip every once in a while and call him Chappie, okay? Michael, tell us how you came to be involved in this particular issue, this gentrification issue in Alberta Street project and so forth.
Well, this project has historical roots dating back to 1992. But before I go another further, I want to thank you, Shahid, for the work that you do in the media. Obviously, you're a renaissance man in the media, because this time last week we were on television, on your television show, doing a little tribute to our ancestors and to our community. Right. So I thank you for your initiatives there.
You.
And I couldn't go any further acknowledging thanking you for the Martin Luther King tribute without mentioning the great Ken Berry, who is the executive producer, and we've been doing this since 1978 on the Martin Luther King tribute. And of course, we started formally with it in 78, but we have had the last 30 years. This will be our 30th consecutive years producing Keep Alive the Dream. And last year, we modified it in honor of the passing of Nelson Mandela to call it Oh Freedom, mm-hmm. and to recognize the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Riders. And this year, although the theme doesn't reflect it, we will be observing the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, mm-hmm. which was written by one of our great mentors, Congressman Augustus F. Hawkins. And when I saw Melissa Lowry in the lobby, I was just grateful that you also are celebrating our young people in this way. She's a young filmmaker,
and
I share some of that in making some documentary films. But your gift to the young people, as is our mission with World Arts Foundation, Inc., is very important. So mm-hmm. thank you for joining in that.
And I also want to take the time to acknowledge the loss of one of your
greats.
One of your greats and your supporters and musical supporter, and Janis Scroggins. I know that you were a big part of the recognition of her contribution and her memory at a funeral. So I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I was blessed to be a part of that celebration. Janis Scroggins, for those of you who do not know, was a premier pianist, a very quiet, very powerful force in the jazz world. And she was self-taught and recognized by all the great musicians who ever come to Portland and perform. They always ask if she's available to join them on stage. She was that good. And her recent passing left us with not only her legacy in terms of her music, histography, and all, but and the beauty of the memory of her performances, but her album, Piano Love. You can go online and find it, and when you do, I was quoted as saying that Janis Grogan's latest album, Piano Love, may be all the music that you'll ever need. It's that good. Right. It's complete. It's nothing but piano and nothing but Janis, and covers the entire genre of ragtime, jazz, bebop, hip-hop, everything. And but mostly she's known as a jazz artist, and that's her contribution and her legacy. The Alberta Street Project is the brainchild of a guy by the name of Dr. Bob Zyback, and we call him Zyback. And Mr. Zyback, Dr. Zyback, is a professor, a former professor at Oregon State University, and we got this notion together and started, he's a forester, and so we come from two opposite ends. We couldn't be more opposite, complementary opposite ends of the spectrum. With the, at the center point, our common focus is young people. And in 1992, because Alberta Street gentrification wasn't even on the table, and gentrification really isn't the topic that we are focused on, ours is on employment of young people and giving them 21st century skills to conduct what we call a cultural resource inventory. That means that within, in Portland, there is a city, a street called Alberta Street, and we took that section that runs from Martin Luther King Boulevard East to 33rd Avenue, five blocks to the south, Prescott, five blocks to the north, Killingsworth. And within that zone, we had our young people count and identify and write about the oldest trees, the oldest people, the biggest building, the number of churches, the number of businesses, and everything that populated and described Alberta Street. Northeast Alberta Street at that time was a serious pocket of blight. And we don't know whether that little study that we did is 172 pages written by our young people who worked with us that summer under a title called Urban Forestry, which mm-hmm. has grown to become its own genre and field of study in some universities. At that time, you could not get a degree in urban forestry. So I thank Bob Zyback for work that he's done in making sure that that kind of information was documented and preserved. Well, 25 years later, fast forward to right now, and what we are proposing is that Portland, particularly the Portland Development Commission, the mayor's office, and a number of businesses around the city collaborate with us to help redo the study. And in so doing and replicating that study, we are using the same methodology, which will validate both studies and give us a template or a footprint, a way to introduce young people to that cultural resource inventory. And now, we didn't have cell phones back in 1992. We didn't have the GIS as the way we have it now, the Geography Information System. And so the maps that we were photocopying back in those days now, we'll have terrific high-definition photographs mm-hmm. of those same areas and tell people what they have seen, what has evolved, and what is the story mm-hmm. on Alberta Street, which is very much like the story on many other streets and boulevards that have been gentrified. What are the factors? And probably the biggest part of the document, it's called the Northeast Alberta Street Cultural Resource Inventory, and then the tagline is with recommendations. So the young people gathered information, they analyzed the data and the information, and then they made recommendations about what should be improved.
To who?
To the city of Portland. And to the general community, because city can only do so much. The rest has to be done by the citizens themselves.
Were any of those recommendations adopted?
Not formally, but you see the many things that they did suggest and that they did recommend, such as improvements in the roadway, the reduction of blight and vacant lots. Well, now the vacant lots have been turned into businesses and new construction for housing and that. And then also recognizing we went all the way back in the document, which you can get online by going to Bob's website, and I'll give you that in just a minute.
Okay. You can excuse my ignorance, but it does sound conscious. A contradiction in terms. You say urban forestry. I guess that's a new field of endeavor.
It sounds a little counterintuitive, urban forestry. But you know, somebody takes care of the trees, and particularly in the Great Pacific Northwest, where we have such an abundance of beautiful trees of every variety.
Well, every community should have some trees. Coming from back east, I say that with heartfelt sincerity, believe me.
And I've been in a number of communities across the land, and people, you go to Michigan, you go to Pennsylvania, even New York City, you'll find a large number of trees. They got them in Atlanta, they have them. And I'm giving a shout out to all our friends in Texas. My mom is home state in Dallas and Houston, you know, are tuning in today too. Mm-hmm. The trees need care. Here's something that a lot of people don't recognize. If you plant trees, which people did 50 and 100 years ago, but you plant them in an area where they're going to grow up into the telephone lines, we overlook that. The electrical lines run from corner to corner on the telephone pole. Now a lot of wiring is underground in our suburban communities, in our newly applied technology and newly applied street development. But in many of our old neighborhoods, if you plant trees on the side of the street where the wires go, then eventually you're going to have to cut out some of those trees, or they're going to greatly interfere with our communication, our power, and so forth. Those are just a little things that,
no, they definitely need manicure.
That is part of urban forestry.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Ideally, what would you like to see come out of your efforts? You and I know you work with Mr. Zyback, and in terms of recreating this study that was done.
We're using the study to complement and replicate what we've done before, but the objective is to put young people to work on using sophisticated technology. Mm-hmm. This technology is transferable. The discipline that's required to show up every day and work under the supervision of scientists just really would make a lot of difference. And it turns out that the National League of Cities put out a proposal that Portland, along with 11 other major cities, Washington, D.C., Newark, New Jersey, Omaha, Nebraska, Des Moines, Iowa, Oakland, California, who have a problem with violence, particularly gun violence in certain communities, that although Portland's problem is not as severe as you might find in some of the larger urban areas, Portland nonetheless was selected by the National League of Cities. And so we believe, borrowing from what we learned in San Francisco and Oakland a few years ago, that nothing stops a bullet like a job. Mm-hmm. With that, then, we want to take some of the youngsters, and this is not a gang enforcement program, this is not a rehabilitation program, but one of prevention, where we'll get some young people involved in some meaningful ways so that the options to digress from a regular life of American citizens doesn't overtake them, and that they can keep their vision clear and prepare themselves for some of the jobs that are waiting for them, that are in great demand, actually, in applied technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, as always, you do good work, Michael, and we want to support you in every way that we can. And we want to thank you for coming in to today, this 4th of July, and also certainly want to thank you for a little kind of pamphlet that you kind of gave me about the gift.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people would be
4th of July by Frederick Douglass.
Yes, and that was written in 18. It was a speech that he gave in 1852. Now, this 1852 was 11 years before the Emancipation Proclamation. Mm-hmm. So he was speaking to a large audience on the 4th of July about what it is to a slave. The 4th of July, and the contradiction of what we see in today's paper, the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal and so forth. And then we don't have to go very far to peel back and recognize that as he did, that America's a very young nation when we compare it to France and Germany and Italy and Egypt, Kemet, as we must say. And so as a young nation, of course, we were making errors and mistakes. And he pointed out that the bravery of the men who took on the king back in 1770, and the first man to die, by the way, was an African-American by the name of Crispus Attucks.
At
the Boston Massacre.
Yeah.
And many people don't know that African-Americans have been contributing in every major conflict. And, of course, as an instructor in aviation, we always point to the Tuskegee Airmen and the great heroic role that they played in demonstrating their heroism, their commitment to the red, white, and blue. Mm-hmm. But in 1852, Frederick Douglass makes a speech called "What to the Slave is the 4th of July. Very interesting reading, and I wanted you as a scholar to have your own copy. I brought you something else, too, that takes us all the way back to Texas and puts us in the radio industry. A radio station in Houston, Texas, where Texas Southern University is, and many of my friends have attended there, called MJWJ. It's a global radio network. So now you're a member of the MJWJ Global Radio Network with Wash Allen's Pecan Prolins. And this is very good candy cookie, my brother. Right. And that's for you, too. I try to fatten you up.
I don't think I need too much more of that. But thank you so much. And I will treasure it and eat it with delight. So thank you so much.
May I give the website?
Real quickly. Uh-huh. You have to let the blues get in here.
Okay, www.orww.org. And my email is mcg@nothingbutquality.com. So we'll urge people to call that and want people to come out tonight to see Theramemory's American Music Program, which is going to be the highlight of the Blues Festival, because they are lighting the fuse right after their performance of these 20 youngsters playing that great jazz and great blues. They're going to have the fireworks show. So come to the main stage and see Theramemory's American Music Program, and thank you very much.
Or you can listen to it right here on Community Radio, KBOO 90.7. Michael, thank you so much. As always, please keep up the good work, and give Ken my regards.
I sure will. Not only Ken, but all the people in North Portland is barbecuing today.
Yeah, right.
Hey. Save me a plate, somebody.
Yours truly, Shahid Hamid, for It Takes a Village. Thanking you for tuning in this time. Looking forward to seeing you next time right here on Community Radio, your inner city blues connection. Stay tuned for live blues coming up on the waterfront stage, and rebroadcast or broadcast also simulcast here on Community Radio 90.7. Until next time, peace. We out.
afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this is a 24 feet segue. What a
you gonna go out and journey the map?
And thanks for the
Hi, this is Ken Jones, and you're listening to KBOO's live broadcast of the 27th Annual Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. We're here today with my buddy Brian. Brian, what do you think?
Oh, Ken, that national anthem, that was fantastic. I want to let people know to come on down this afternoon. We've got plenty of room for now, but get here now. Don't get here later. Ride your bike down. Bring a lock. Lock up your bike and enjoy the festival. The first act we have coming up is Blind Boy Paxton.
Oh, man, there was a big buzz on him last year.
Yeah.
And he was invited back this year. Yeah. He's playing like four times, but his first time on the main stage today.
That's fantastic. Blind since 16 years old, Paxton is a virtuoso multi-instrumentalist who picks banjo and guitar, plays harmonica and piano, other instruments. He's a fantastic entertainer, just a bundle of joy. It's going to be fantastic. But you need to get down here right now, or be sure and tune in KBOO at 90.7 FM. We're also broadcasting on some other translators around this state.
Oh, yeah, it's a whole new network this year, the Oregon Community Media. It's a network of low power and FM stations all across Oregon. Brian, we're going in now into, this feed is going into Ashland, Medford, Shady Cove. I have no idea where that is.
I've been there. It's beautiful. Little tiny space. Really cool.
Bend, Cottage Grove, Staten, Salem, and the Warm Springs Reservation. Oh, we want to, Brian and I were talking a little bit before the broadcast, and you want to get on down here if you're planning. It fills up pretty quickly on the 4th of July.
It does. The weather is beautiful. Bring your sunscreen, bring a low-backed lawn chair, $10, a couple cans of food. They're asking for a donation. It's a benefit for the Oregon Food Bank. If you can't get down here, though, keep KBOO locked in all weekend long. We're going to be broadcasting the whole festival as much as we're allowed to do. And just lock it in here and enjoy the blues. Like if you're at home doing yard work, whatever it is, if you can't come down, please. Here we go, Blind Boy Paxton May on the stage. Let's go to him right now.
Good afternoon, friends. It is a pleasure to see y'all here so early in the afternoon. I will arrange these microphones so that you can hear my American music. We'll start with a couple tunes for dancing. I hope y'all like dancing. They are distinctly American. You will hear bagpipes. You will hear the pitter-patter of little First Nation feet. You hear a little Baptist shout. A little farmer's complaining. You'll hear it all, hell. Thank you.
You are listening to a live broadcast of the Waterfront Blues Festival on Oregon Community Media Stations KBOO Portland, KSKQ FM Ashland, KPOV FM Bend, KSOW LP Cottage Grove, KMUZ FM Turner, KPIX LP Staten, KWSO FM Warm Springs, and KYAQ on the web from Lincoln County.